There's been a lot of talk about this next song. Maybe too much talk. This song is not a rebel song. This song is Someday, Bloody Someday.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is November 17th, 2013, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Sunday, Bloody Sunday, Epistaxis and Transexamic Acid. We do have a guest skeptic today, and it's Dr. Eric Hanel, an assistant professor of emergency medicine at McMaster University and the newest member of the Beam Dream team.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me on your podcast. Happy to be here to talk about, an important, if not very common, presentation in the emergency department.
Oh, I've seen a few nosebleeds in my day.
Absolutely. I usually see them on the tracker board and groan at the same time.
Oh, come on. Every case is a good case there, Eric.
Very true. Very true.
Well, let's just dive right in because we like to start with case scenarios. And the case scenario for today's podcast, Sunday Bloody Sunday, is a 72-year-old man presents with epistaxis. He has no history of coagulopathy, but he does have a history of hypertension, coronary artery disease, and osteoarthritis. His vital signs are 154 over 92, heart rate 70, respiratory rate is 14. He is taking an ACE inhibitor, an hydrochlorothiazide, and a baby aspirin a day. And the question we have for this podcast is topical transamic acid better than nasal packing for an anterior epistaxis? So Eric, let's go through some background information before we dive into that paper that you picked for the podcast. Is that okay with you, Eric?
That's fantastic.
All right, so I have 11 questions I'm going to ask you. Why 11, you ask? Because it's my second favorite number. So let's go through 11 questions, and I'll throw them out there, and you can provide that Beam Dream Team expert opinion.
No problem.
So question number one, what is the incidence of epistaxis?
Sure, incidence is always a great place to start. We all know nosebleeds are very common, and it has been researched. More than half of us, in fact, 60% of the population at some point will experience some kind of nosebleed. Like a lot of things in emergency medicine, though, it does have a bimodal distribution. The majority of admissions for refractory hemorrhage usually occur in the young and the old, so less than 10 years or greater than 60 years, which does make sense. It has been studied in terms of serious epistaxis, and back in 2005, a U.S. study determined that there were 7 deaths they thought directly related to epistaxis, and not surprisingly, these were all in the second phase of that bimodal distribution, all over 75 years.
You know, when I was doing some background information before we did the podcast, Eric, I found a number of 70 to 80% of all nosebleeds, they couldn't find the cause. And I thought that was a little unusual because I thought the number one cause, actually the 10 most common causes, was digital trauma.
Absolutely. But who's going to admit to that?
Exactly. And so I think that's why 70 to 80% of them went undiagnosed for the actual cause, because their finger was up their nose earlier.
You get the two populations. You get the young kid whose parents say there's no way little Johnny was picking his nose. And you get your older patient who may not remember they were picking their nose.
So question number two, what are the common causes besides, of course, your 10 digits? What are the common causes of epistaxis?
Sure thing. Well, epistaxis is usually going to come from some kind of hemorrhages, and you can either have local or kind of systemic causes. So any kind of chronic irritation, foreign body, even topical medications kind of sprayed up into the nose can cause actual bleeding. And some of your systemic causes predisposing you to bleeding are going to contribute to hemorrhage from one or both or either of the blood plexuses in the nasopharynx. There's a division of anterior to posterior, which we have all heard of back in medical school, anterior being localized to the famous Kesselbach's plexus. Your posterior bleeds, or deep bleeds, are primarily from a single vessel branch from your sphenopalatine artery. Usually they're a lot more serious. The problem is you do have this postnasal bleeding, which some people will confuse as an automatic posterior bleed, and this would be blood visible in the posterior nasopharynx from a brisk or uncontrolled anterior bleed. Still has implications of aspiration and post-epistaxis, malina, gastritis, vomiting, but a different kind of beast.
All right, so In this case, I made the patient hypertensive for a reason. And that's because question number three is, does hypertension cause epistaxis?
That's a great question, not only for the podcast, but that's a real-life question patients are going to ask you all the time. My high blood pressure is causing epistaxis, and I don't know about you, but I don't remember that being one of the end organs for my hypertensive crisis or emergency. So this is debated in the literature quite a bit. Often patients, when they do present, they will have elevated blood pressure, like a lot of people in the emergency department, but keep in mind, white coat hypertension can be present in up to 20% of our patients presenting. And the thought here is that chronic hypertension does lead to atherosclerosis and fragile vessels, especially in that anterior Kesselbach's plexus, which is going to predispose you to bleeding. So in a way, it might contribute to bleeding, but it doesn't necessarily cause it. It might be useful to do some primary care with our epistaxis, though. We're all going to arrange some form of follow-up for our nosebleeds, and you might want to remind the patient with high blood pressure they should discuss this with their primary care provider. Not only for the implications of long-term hypertension, but also for the implications of recurrent epistaxis.
Can't forget about the primary care, preventative medicine.
Very important.
So question number four takes us a step back, actually. How do you diagnose anterior versus posterior epistaxis? Because this is important with management.
Right, that's the million-dollar question when you're first dealing with your nosebleed. I mean, some of it's going to come right off of your CTAS scores and your trauma board. I mean, the more serious posterior epistaxis are usually a lot more uncontrolled and might be actual sicker patient, if you may. But in reality, you should be able to figure it out. You should be able to visualize 80% of your anterior epistaxis bleeds. Maybe not quite 80%. Some of the research was from otolaryngologists who admittedly might be a little bit better at looking up the nose than we are in the emergency department. But it's good to have a system on how to do it. Always best to start with your personal protective gear. These patients continue to talk, cough, sputter, and the room usually ends up a bloody mess. Visualization is key. Make your life as easy as possible. So to visualize, try and use some kind of speculum. Usually it'll be found in your ENT kits or in your actual ENT room. And if you can continue to keep your hands free, headlamps are great. Then you've got two hands versus one to do what you have to do to visualize the nasal pharynx. Patient positioning, like anything else, super important. Make sure the patient's sitting up. That's the patient could be sitting up, sputtering in your face. And one thing I didn't learn back in Boy Scouts when I was learning how to deal with nosebleeds is blowing out the clots. I was always thought, you know, direct pressure was key, but if that direct pressure is affected by a clot and not actually causing outside pressure on the vessel, you're not going to get good hemostasis. So get the patient to really make a mess, blow out all those clots. If they're not doing a great job at it, consider normal saline or sterile water to irrigate up the clots with a sterile flush. On the back or posterior oropharynx, get the patient to rinse their mouth out, spit, clear out as much blood as possible so you can take a really good look in there at those sites. It's important to mention at this standpoint, though, really remember we're dealing with kind of uncomplicated anterior nosebleed. So really look at your patient in total. Consider your signs and symptoms of hemorrhagic hypovolemic shock. Remember, our bimodal distribution deals with vulnerable populations like the young and the old. In the youth, you might be dealing with congenital abnormalities like polyps or an undiagnosed blood dyscrasia. Elderly, you've got comorbidities, antiplatelets on board, anticoagulants that could make those bleeds a lot more serious and could push you into actual early compensated shock. So really be cognizant of that. The key when you're examining those, you want to see that anterior vessel. In fact, I know on my patients that come back, if I've got a chart where I said or documented that I saw an anterior vessel, that's like chart code for another doctor to say it's not a posterior bleed. And posterior bleeds are uncommon. They predict or they estimate around 5% are thought to be posterior. And really the definition comes as no identifiable anterior source of bleed, and you must see blood in the posterior oropharynx.
How about COAG studies though? I mean, Eric, do you choose wisely or do you do COAG studies in all these nosebleeds?
Yeah, great question. COAG studies are not indicated in simple, uncomplicated epistaxis. Unless the patient's already taking an anticoagulant and you're doing a bit of primary care again, or you're making sure they're not they're over anticoagulated, or you're dealing with a refractory pediatric hemorrhagic nosebleed where you think you might have an undiagnosed blood dyscrasia, coagulation studies really don't help you.
So it sounds like you are choosing wisely. How about reversing the Coumadin? Somebody comes in with Coumadin. So this is question number six. They're on Coumadin. Do you reverse it when they come in with epistaxis?
Yeah, another great question. Reversing Coumadin is a hot topic. Anyone who's bleeding, your natural knee-jerk reflex is to reverse that Coumadin. But remember, we're dealing with uncomplicated epistaxis. This is not a life-threatening bleed. So you're going to treat this just as you normally would any patient coming in with any bleeding anywhere. What you want to do is you want to figure out if the patient is super therapeutic or subtherapeutic. Remember, they're on warfarin for a reason, and that warfarin is protecting them from some form of life-threatening or life-changing event. So more likely than not, that is their bigger problem, not their current nosebleed. So you can actually do more harm by getting too overexcited to reverse Coumadin and make them subtherapeutic. So these are presentations where they're not in hemorrhagic shock, they're not in life-threatening bleeds. You just want to manage that INR appropriately, same as you would do for any bleed. And similar for antiplatelets, there is no reason to hold an antiplatelet in a non-life-threatening nosebleed that you can gain control of and emerge.
So do you like giving them oral vitamin K then if their, you know, INR is greater than 10 and they're bleeding?
So if someone's INR is greater than 10 and they are bleeding, there, we do have a few guidelines to help us with that. The American College of Chest Physicians, for example, does recommend INR greater than 10 bleeding to give 1 to 2 milligrams of oral vitamin K and hold their warfarin with appropriate follow-up. Remember, the vitamin K is not going to help you in the department right now with the bleed, but it may help the patient, you know, a day down the road when they're trying to correct their over anticoagulation.
Okay, so I've given you some pretty easy questions here, Eric. It's time to throw you something a little harder. Question number 7. Do you do anything different for all these new oral anticoagulants? You know, the new ones on the market. Are you doing anything different with those?
Oh, absolutely. So this is the question I can answer where I can really eliminate my future in big pharma in one fell swoop. Right. So the new anticoagulants you're talking about are things like dabigatran or Pradex, rivaroxaban, Xarelto, or apixaban, Eliquis. These are the direct thrombin 2 and the factor 10A inhibitors. This is very debated in the literature, and at every EM conference I've gone to in the past 2 years, there's always been some kind of talk on the newer oral anticoagulants, or the NOACs. They even have a fancy abbreviation now. It's key to know there are no specific antidotes, so there's no direct antidote for each one of those anticoagulants, but there are arguments on either side to use things like purified protein, protein complexes, or PCC, but these are based on lab effects and correcting abnormal coagulation studies rather than affecting actual bleeding times. And again, I want to reemphasize, we're talking about non-life-threatening, simple, uncomplicated, most often anterior epistaxis, which we're going to gain control of without affecting coags. We're going to gain control with local measures, so we will not be doing any kind of PCC or rapid reversal. That's really only indicated for life-threatening bleeds. Do keep in mind with these newer anticoagulants, though, they have very short half-lives. So looking at patient compliance, there's actually a good chance your patient who's coming in with a bleed, apparently on one of these meds, might have missed 1, 2, maybe 3 doses. And they're, at that standpoint, exact same as your uncoagulated patient.
Question number 8, though, I'd like to just take us through how would you manage an epistaxis, just in general. They're coming in and they're bleeding. How do you take that patient in general now? That's question number 8, and manage their nosebleed.
Great. And with exams, that is a common question you get. What is your approach to epistaxis? And unfortunately, it seemed like as a resident, probably every staff you work with had a different approach. But believe it or not, there is a published approach. And if you want to look real slick on your exams, you can quote the Dundee Protocol out of the UK.
Crikey. It's out of the UK and not Australia?
Absolutely. It's rather complex, like most protocols, but you can break it down and make it really simple. It really breaks down to visualizing the bleed, which is similar to what we just talked about, direct therapy, tamponade, and vascular intervention. Now, the vascular intervention is nothing that's going to be happening in the emergency department. That's more for our ear, nose, and throat colleagues to help us out. But visualization, direct therapy, and tamponade are things we can do and get often great results with. So it starts with things like topical vasoconstrictor preparations. Everybody's got their own formulations of what they use. So things like adrenaline, if you're following the Dundee protocol, or epinephrine back here, using the 1 in 1,000 concentration seems to work well, but people have used other concentrations. The important thing is to get some kind of topical epinephrine in there for vasoconstriction. To that end, some people do use phenylephrine, kind of a 0.5% to 1% solutions. And I heard when I was training in the States that cocaine was quite common in Canadian emergency rooms back in the day, and I heard 4% from my colleagues worked really well.
I don't remember ever using it, but I can imagine that, you know, if you did put cocaine up someone's nose who was bleeding, whether they continued to bleed or not, they really wouldn't care.
So cocaine, not around anymore, apparently, from what I've heard. Another topical solution used is things like the oxymetallazine, the afferent solutions. Not a lot of studies on any of these solutions. Everyone's using kind of something different, and some people are actually using quite dilute concentrations of epinephrine and getting great results. They have shown, though, that a lot of these things, with fears of epinephrine and cocaine and whatnot inducing hypertension, isn't really an issue. And I haven't been out for long from residency, but I have picked up my own tricks as well. And I found a lot of times I'm taking tricks from the pediatric emergency department and bringing it to the adult world. And despite what they say about topical things like LET on mucous membranes, I have used LET or lidocaine, epinephrine, tetracaine mixtures in the nose and actually in the mouth, and it has worked great. The nice thing about that is it is giving you some lidocaine as well as the vasoconstriction part to prepare the patient for the next phase of the Dundee protocol, which is the tamponade phase or direct therapy phase, which may cause the patient discomfort. So best to topicalize them if you can with some form. So to that end, the silver nitrate is the topical direct therapy that we use in the emergency department commonly. And I actually did not know there were differences in silver nitrate till I started going to a few conferences and seeing a few tricks of the trade type talks. But there is two concentrations, 75% and 95%. Either is actually fine to use, but that's with a caveat. The 95% does cause a significantly deeper burn than the 75%. And by deeper, it means at least double the depth. So if you're dealing with an anterior bleed anywhere around the septum, you can easily perforate the septum with the 95% silver nitrate, especially if you do bilateral cautery, which I know often they tell us not to do. But with a 75% silver nitrate stick, even bilaterally, you're very unlikely to perforate the septum unless you go beyond kind of a 5-second maximum cautery application time. Anything beyond that, you do run the risk of perforating septums, increased pain, or permanent tattooing for the patient, which they may not appreciate. There's a few other topical therapies to use. Often in the emergency, you can find things like SurgiCell or SurgiFoam. Those are really just a great absorbents, and you can actually kind of MacGyver some of your other packs by wrapping up your commercial packs in SurgiCell or SurgiFoam to kind of get some hemostasis if need be.
I like your MacGyver reference. Question number 9 then. Are there any differences between the effectiveness of different packing options that are available to us in the emergency department?
Yeah, great question. What I would say for some of these different devices is there are probably differences published, and I've seen things published on them, but of course they're going to be sponsored by the manufacturers who make these devices. The best device in use in emergency department is going to be the one that you know how to use and you have available in your department. In fact, ribbon pack is probably the best thing to learn. It is going to be available everywhere, and it's kind of almost like a custom fit to the patient's nares. Really important to remember with the ribbon gauze, you coat it in something like a petroleum jelly or an antibiotic ointment, something to give it a little bit of lubrication to be placed into the nose. And then it's just packed down with an alligator forceps from posterior to anterior, back and forth until you actually get hemostasis. And it makes a nice kind of custom fit. I'd also like to put in a plug for using bilateral packing, even if you have a single side nare bleed, just for the fact that you'll get that extra pressure from the other side to maybe help with hemostasis.
Well, I'm just going to pick up on something you just said there, Eric, as a nice segue for question number 10, because you talked about putting that ribbon of packing into some kind of petroleum jelly or into some kind of antibiotic preparation. And that's question 10. Should we be using antibiotics in these epistaxis patients?
And the question comes from the general fear out there that the nose is a dirty place, it's not sterile, and there's lots of feared infectious complications of us putting foreign bodies in the nose for hemostasis. I only use the example of antibiotic ointment for the fact that it's pretty similar to petroleum jelly. It actually facilitates the packing more than anything else. We know that 1/3 of the population do have Staph aureus in their nares. And we know that 1/3 of those Staph aureus do produce actual toxin responsible for infection or shock syndromes. If there is a concurrent infection in your patient and that might have contributed to their bleed, absolutely. Use antibiotics as you normally would for that infection. Antibiotics that are going to cover the bacteria found in the nose are going to be things like topical antibiotics. Most preparations will cover nasal bacteria. Clavulin will do a great job, or you can consider macrolides for panallergic. Anytime you do a posterior pack, a lot of the references will say you should actually give some form of antibiotic, but a bit of a caveat with that. A lot of that posterior packing research comes post-surgical or comes from the otolaryngology research, not from the eMERGE research. You can imagine a lot of our, well, all of our posterior packs are going to get some kind of advanced care. So not a lot of research from our world on that. People do consider antibiotics for anterior packs, specifically if they're in for a prolonged time period. So if you have a pack in for 48 to 72 hours, often people will do some form of antibiotic, but that could include topical antibiotics. It does not have to be systemic antibiotics.
So Eric, final question, number 11, how long should you leave anterior packings in?
That's a great question. That's what I had when I first started as a new staff. I was wondering, when should I be bringing these people back? And am I going to be getting upset coworkers that I brought them back too late, too early? So I do what I normally would do. And I went to the literature and tried to find an answer and unfortunately did not find a great answer. There is no strong literature, especially for eMERGE treated anterior packs, on how long they should be left in. 1 to 3 days is common, but there's been reports of up to a week in surgical cases. Keep in mind, these packs are placed in the OR versus the ER. There is some data to suggest a minimum of 24 hours, which does make sense, and maybe 48 hours for a high-risk case, though that research wasn't really clear at defining what was a high-risk case. It's really a gestalt.
Well, let's bring it all the way back to that 72-year-old man who came into your eMERGE. He was doing reasonably well, but he had an anterior bleed. And you found a paper that might help us in our treatment and another option for this man.
This is a paper by primary author Zahed. It's entitled A New and Rapid Method for Epistaxis Treatment Using Injectable Forms of Transglycemic Acid Topically. And it's a randomized controlled trial that was published in the September edition of the American Journal of Emergency Medicine.
Wow, 2 months, hot off the shelf, ready to go. I love it. So the PICO for this was the population was adult patients presenting to the emergency department, and there was 216 of them in this study. The intervention group got a 15-centimeter cotton packing soaked with transexamic acid, which was 500 milligrams in a 5-mil solution. And then that packing was removed after the bleeding was stopped. So that was the intervention group. The control group had standard cotton packing soaked in epinephrine with lidocaine for 10 minutes. And then that packing was removed, and then it was repacked with cotton covered with tetracycline as an antibiotic. And then what the authors looked for outcome was how long it took to stop bleeding. That was one outcome. The length of stay in the emergency department was another outcome. How many patients rebled at 24 hours and at 1 week, and finally, patient satisfaction. So Eric, let's go through these results because they were rather impressive.
Yeah, they definitely were. They're four main kind of result categories of hemostasis, discharge, complication, patient satisfaction, and rebleeds are quite dramatic. In fact, within 10 minutes, bleeding was stopped in the TXA group 71% of the time versus 31% of times in the control. And furthermore, these patient groups with the transexamic acid, 95% were discharged in under 2 hours as compared to 6.4% in the control group. So some significant differences there that have real world translation to us working in the emergency department.
Yeah, trying to keep the eMERGE going there with the flow there. If you can stop someone's nosebleed in 10 minutes with transexamic acid, I mean, almost 3/4 of those patients had that happen within that time frame, and yet 2/3 of the control group were still bleeding after 10 minutes. And that length of stay, that discharge within 2 hours, I mean, that's going to help your eMERGE flow. If you can get rid of 95% of patients within 2 hours compared to 6%, I mean, the odds ratios on this were really, really good.
Absolutely. And consider this is just a Pledget soaked with transaxamic acid. I'm not trying to find whatever pack in whatever emergency department I'm using has. I'm not trying to find all the equipment I need to kind of place that pack. I'm not having to have long conversations with the patient about informed discharge with the pack. I'm just using a simple Pledget, and I'm getting the majority of those patients out of there within 2 hours. It's actually fantastic. Similarly with the results, right off the bat, patient satisfaction was very high. These patients don't have packs placed. They do not have to come back to the emergency department or see another MD to have anything removed from their nose. They're actually not leaving the department with a string hanging out of their nose taped to their face.
Hey, my satisfaction would go way up. I mean, it was double. I mean, it went from 44% in the control group to 85%. 85% of patients. Well, yeah, of course you're going to be more happy not walking out of there with that long stringy thing hanging out of your nose. I mean, really, really nice patient satisfaction numbers.
Absolutely. And I would totally agree. I would see why I'd be much more satisfied with the transaxamic acid. And when you worry about complications, the complication rate was no different between the group, about 4.7% in the TXA group and 11% with an insignificant p-value for complications. So you're using a treatment that has much more patient satisfaction, better ED flow, less complications.
And then your bounce back rate was really good too. I mean, rebleeding at 24 hours was 4.7% in the treatment group versus 12.8%. So a tripling, you know, if you just did the control group, you're three times as likely to have a re-bleed and re-present to the emergency department. Same similar results at 1 week. You only had 2.8% people in the transamic acid have a re-bleed at 1 week versus 11%. So again, significant numbers for re-bleed.
Absolutely. You're getting happier patients out of the department faster without having them to return the department. It's definitely a win situation.
So it's no surprise that the authors concluded, quote, topical application of an injectable form, and we're not injecting it, but an injectable form of transaxamic acid was better than anterior nasal packing in the initial treatment of idiopathic anterior epistaxis, end of quote. We've got some comments, some critical review comments, some best evidence in emergency medicine. And being the new member of the Beam Dream team, Eric, I'm going to hand it over to you and say, what do you think of this paper?
Yeah, so going through kind of our rigorous Beam kind of scrutiny of the paper, you can see that really this was a good randomized control trial to look at another way to treat a very common problem in the emergency department. So it's very applicable. They did have a difference between the two groups when they looked at the TXA group. That group did actually have a history of kind of recurrent epistaxis, so 58% versus 14. But in reality, this could exaggerate the effectiveness of the intervention. The study did not apply to posterior nosebleeds. They also did not include patients with pre-existing bleeding disorders, major traumas, super therapeutic INRs, or when a bleeding vessel was visible. Assumingly, they would just treat that topically. There was no blinding to the providers and patients, which could have introduced some bias. And also, there's no grading of the epistaxis. And we know there's not a great grading system out there. So we don't really know if topical TXA is better or worse than packing, depending on the severity of the bleed. But the Beam bottom line is that for anterior epistaxis, consider soaking the packing in TXA to stop the bleeding and get them home sooner.
So the case resolution in the one that we set up was this 72-year-old man who came in with epistaxis was informed of the traditional method, which involved packing of his nose for about 3 days with follow-up to remove. And then the alternative was to try packing with another solution, the transamic acid, which has been shown in this one study to stop the bleeding earlier, get you out of the ED faster, with no difference in side effects, less rebleeding, and has greater patient satisfaction. And of course, to no surprise, he chose wisely and went with the TXA packing, left after 1 hour, and did not bounce back to the emerge on your next shift. For our Keener contest last week, unfortunately, there was no winner. It must have been too hard. Eric, can you give the Keener contest for this week?
Definitely. So for the Keener contest for this week for Skeptic's Guide to the Emergency Medicine, what are the feared infectious complications for anterior or posterior packing of the nasopharynx?
So if you know what the feared infectious complications to packing an epistaxis are, then send that to thesgem@gmail.com. If you're the first one with the correct answer, I will, of course, send you a cool skeptical prize. There's one more thing I wanted to mention before we finish up, Eric, and thank you very, very much for being on the show. But I want to give a shout-out, and this shout-out is to a great new FOMED resource that I want to mention. And it fits well with the theme of this not being a rebel podcast. I mean, this is Sunday, bloody Sunday on the SGEM. But there is a new rebel in emergency medicine, and it's a project by Dr. Salim Razay, and I hope I said that correctly. He is a clinical assistant professor in emergency medicine and internal medicine at the University of Texas. And his new REBEL project, REBEL stands for Razay, Evidence-Based Evaluation of Literature in the Emergency Medicine and Internal Medicine. Salim has got some great content out there, and I suggest you check it out. So again, Eric, thank you very much for agreeing to be on it. It's great to introduce you as the new Beam Dream Team member to the SGEM audience. So I'd like to hand it over to you and give you the privilege of saying the SGEM tagline.
Great. Remember, please be skeptical of what you learn. And that includes what you heard here today on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.